Coming up is the news.
Iran reiterates its demands for the U.S. to return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal, including the removal of sanctions which bar Tehran from benefiting from the deal. NATO says it started the withdrawal of its mission from Afghanistan following a decision by U.S. President Joe Biden to bring American forces home. And Moscow says that the U.S. president's remarks against Russia show Washington's reluctance to abandon hopeless attempts to accuse the country of malign activities. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran has reaffirmed its demands to return to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. This as negotiations are underway in Vienna to try to revive the landmark agreement. But will the delegations present in Austrian capital come to an understanding to salvage the accord?
Iran and the remaining signatories of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are holding a new round of talks in Vienna in an effort to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. As talks continue over a spat of issues, the Islamic Republic has reiterated its demands for returning back to compliance with the JCPOA. That's according to two sources who informed Press TV of the conditions.
Iran's demands regarding JCPOA talks. The United States must remove sanctions that prevent Iran from benefiting from the JCPOA. Legal institutions will accept the outcome of the Vienna talks only once all U.S. sanctions are removed and the removal is verified by Tehran. The United States has to guarantee that it won't use the snapback mechanism after rejoining the deal. The United States has to pay for the losses it inflicted on Iran by withdrawing from the JCPOA.
According to the sources, the United States has to guarantee that foreign companies cooperate with the Islamic Republic following Washington's rejoining of the agreement. Press TV analysts say CATSA and Iran Sanctions Act, visa bans, the dollar U-turn, and Section 311 of the Patriot Act are fundamental obstacles to Iran's gains under the JCPOA. Press TV analysts say among such obstacles are also a number of U.S. President's executive orders that prohibit transactions with respect to Iran and block property of Iranian individuals, governments, and financial institutions. They also say failing to remove sanctions at 120-day or 180-day sanction waivers also deprive Iran of benefits stipulated under the JCPOA. The JCPOA revival talks come as Iranian officials have time and again warned that Tehran will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it detects that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran insists that the 2015 nuclear agreement can only be salvaged if its demands are met and that its conditions are the country's definitive policy. Former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Tehran, however, waited for a year, gave leeway to the European signatories to make up for the U.S. pullout, but the so-called E3 failed to abide by their commitments. Now, with the new U.S. administration in office for nearly 100 days, Washington has so far failed to take any solid measure to return to the deal. All in all, Iran says the ball is in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all the sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of predecessor known as maximum pressure campaign and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic.
Political analyst Sayed Mostafa Khoshpesh says that Iran seeks to block any deceitful measures by the U.S. regarding the nuclear deal.
Some might ask why Iran is so persistent in asking for these conditions. The answer is that Iran has experienced so much deceitful measures under the nuclear deal by the United States, and the U.S. deceitful measures have inflicted harms over the deal. So Iran is trying to block any such move in future, including the fact that they have been suspending the sanctions. They did it, actually, under Obama. but just over the paper, not in action, despite the very fact that JCPOA contents say that the sanctions should be terminated, annulled forever, for good. They just did suspensions for 4 month to 6 month periods. And this means that no foreign company would ever be willing to risk its investment and capital. So what Iran is asking actually comes in the aftermath of the U.S. reciprocal measures. And it wants the deal to work and to stay alive forever if it's going to be revoked. And it comes in the aftermath of the U.S. wrongful wounds and wrongful deeds.
Fresh clashes are reported between Kyrgyz and Tajik forces at their disputed border just hours after a ceasefire agreement was announced. Local Kyrgyz officials said the border guards are engaged in intense exchange of fire in the Lelek district of the southwestern Batken province. The country says three Kyrgyz people, including a child, have died in the border clashes with Tajikistan. Kyrgyzstan's foreign ministry had earlier said that complete ceasefire will go into effect in 1400 GMT. Tajikistan, however, didn't immediately comment on that truce. The conflict, the heaviest in years between the two former Soviet nations, began over access to water. Over a third of the border between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan is disputed. Clashes break out sporadically between the two over territorial disputes. Meanwhile, president of the Palestinian Authority has ruled out the prospect of holding elections if Israel does not allow voting in Jerusalem al-Quds. Mahmoud Abbas said that Israel blames its political uncertainty for ignoring requests to hold elections in Al-Quds. However, he said the Palestinians will not fall for unacceptable Israeli excuses. Meanwhile, various Palestinian groups, including Hamas, say that they will not accept any excuses for postponing or calling off the elections. The Palestinian resistance movement called for national dialogue to resolve issues concerning voting in Al-Quds. Abbas's Fatah party and rival Hamas had agreed to hold legislative polls on May 22nd and a presidential vote come 31st of July. Hamas is expected to do well in parliamentary elections, while Fatah's prospects have been threatened by splinter factions. And now welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Let's go. And now the North Atlantic Treaty Organization says it's begun withdrawing its troops from Afghanistan. NATO described the drawdown as an orderly, coordinated, and deliberate process. U.S.-backed military alliance said it plans to complete its pullout in a few months without specifying a date. Separately, the White House confirmed U.S. troops have begun leaving the country as well. President Joe Biden announced earlier this month that the U.S. will withdraw all of its forces from Afghan territory by the 11th of September, ending his country's longest military engagement. NATO has around 9,600 forces in Afghanistan, 2,500 of them American. Joining us now for the program is E. Michael Jones, editor at Culture Wars Online, or Culture Wars Magazine out of South Bend, Indiana, and Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer, joining us out of San Francisco, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there with you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. Your initial thoughts after 20 years plus, seems like this thing's about to really happen, isn't it?
Yes, it's been the longest war in U.S. history. It's also over a crucial piece of territory, which was established by Rudyard Kipling. He called it the Great Game. He said anyone who controls the Hindu Kush controls the Eurasian landmass and the approaches to India. The withdrawal from that is a sign of the shrinking now of the American empire. The American empire just got too big. They can't maintain this anymore, and so the United States is pulling out in a move that is reminiscent of the pullout of Vietnam, where you basically declare victory and then leave the people up to themselves to defend themselves.
Thank you, Mr. E. Michael Jones. And Scott Bennett, welcome to the program, bud. If you're safe and doing well out there in Northern Cali. Scott, your initial thoughts on this, and then when we saw NATO and the U.S. Give that presser last month that they're withdrawing troops and they've achieved their objective there, what was the objective, and was that just some kind of a theater, or was the U.S. and NATO objective really achieved on Afghan soil?
I think they were recognizing that the objective, which was started under George Bush and Dick Cheney, which was based upon a fraudulent false flag attack of the 9/11 situation that was blamed on the former CIA agent Tim Osmond, also known as Osama bin Laden, and then conveniently transferring that guilt over to the nation of Afghanistan, the Taliban, and then launching this reckless invasion based on fraud and deceit of the American people of the world, that is finally coming to an end because of the natural deterioration of any effort built on lies. The entire event was built on lies. The entire campaign was built on lies. And it was also accompanied with the music of incompetence and stupidity because they failed to cultivate a soft war, an information war, a psychological war, or campaign, or persuasion operation, whatever you want to call it. They failed constantly, consistently, and inevitably because of the knuckle-dragging stupidity behind the military, State Department, CIA information operations to persuade the Afghan people to enter into some semblance of modernity that is not defined by the U.S., but is defined by a community of nations. So the U.S., by its arrogance and recklessness, has really run out of gas in the entire Afghan theater. It has generated enormous hostility, and now it realizes it's not ever going anywhere. We've run our entire gamut. No one likes us in that country. And the reason that the government and the military are desperate to keep the United States is because of the civil war that is brewing. Now, how that may be contained is another matter, but it has to be done through joint operations, I think, with Russia, with Iran, with China, with neighbors, Pakistan, India, all of the ones that are around that area, need to try and cultivate a message operation so that the Taliban are not being self-perceived in violation of the religion, but at the same time, the Afghan government are able to stand up and protect its people from any sort of descent into authoritarianism or warlord rule or anything that resembles that sort of barbaric violence.
And Mr. E. Michael Jones, so after I mentioned 20 years plus, NATO and U.S. Forces, their Afghan project or their Afghan war, whatever you want to call it, let me know your interpretation of what they gained from it and what they lost throughout the time.
It was my understanding that Afghanistan was crucial to the heroin trade. We know that the CIA was involved in the heroin trade in the Golden Triangle after the Vietnam War, because Jimmy Carter had cut off their funding. They needed an extra source of funding, and they started it there. Then when they lost that after the fall of Vietnam, they moved to Afghanistan. This is what everyone that I know is saying this. And the problem was that the Taliban stopped heroin, opium production. My understanding was that's why the invasion took place. I talked to someone, it was our illustrious gay mayor of South Bend who went to Afghanistan to build up his resume, and even he admitted he was over there working with money laundering and drug dealing. And even he admitted that for every year that the United States was there, the heroin trade, opium trade increased. So that had to be part of the operation. It seems to me there's no other explanation plausible explanation for what was going on there. They then got involved in social engineering. They tried to bring feminism into Afghanistan, and I had the pleasure of getting to meet a young lady from Herat who is here at the University of Notre Dame studying, and she was going to go back and spread feminism among the Afghanistanis. I feel sorry for the people who were involved in this thing. She hasn't gone back yet, but I mean, her predecessor was blown up in a car bomb put there by the Taliban because they saw this as subversive influence. So across the board, it's been a disaster. Disaster for the United States because of the heroin that swept into this country. Disaster for the people of Afghanistan who were lured into collaborating with a group that's now going to pull out and leave them defenseless.
Thank you. And Scott, we have a couple minutes left. Your final thoughts on this. You can wait on Mr. E. Michael Jones's words or your own final thoughts. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Jones is exactly right, and I agree 100% that opium and the heroin was told to be by military people that were over there, in fact, that they couldn't leave and didn't want to leave because they didn't want to surrender that market to other parties, other countries. So it's an admittance that the U.S. went in for the heroin opium control. It was also outlined in a memo called Deep Black, which I saw personally, that came out of the Obama, Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer, Department of Justice that was being trained in these opium wars and these Golden Triangle operations. So this has been long part of the CIA left sort of financing of a lot of these wars and escapades. I think it needs to end in a positive role, but it will not end positively unless there is a group of nations that are collaboratively participating, and it is not a sole U.S. effort. And I think every American wants their sons and daughters out of Afghanistan, out of Iraq, out of Syria, out of Libya, out of Lebanon, out of all of these countries, because we have ruined the American diplomatic language and resume and friendship. And all of these nations have lost thousands and thousands of people and are looking at the U.S. As a departing empire. And that was never what the Constitution or the Founding Fathers or the American people ever wanted. This was done by war profiteers and war criminals, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Barack Obama. Donald Trump had an opportunity to stop it. And I think to a certain degree, he set in motion these changes. And now Biden is really an incompetent zombie that's out of his mind, and he's being handled and manipulated by others. But I think the writing is on the wall that these adventures are over and the American people aren't going to tolerate them. And they're not going to tolerate a shift in aggression against Russia or Iran. That is something to be known, that the world today is sick and tired of the American military juggernaut, and they're not going to tolerate it. And the Americans would better go back to their own country and get their own house in order and not continue these empire operations.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Mr. E. Michael Jones there joining us out of South Bend, and Scott Bennett there joining us from San Francisco, California. And that's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Russia says the U.S. president's latest remarks against Moscow show Washington's reluctance to abandon hopeless attempts to pressure the country with accusations of malign activities. Russian Foreign Ministry welcomed Joe Biden's remark that Washington isn't seeking escalation with Moscow. It, however, noted that the U.S. administration's words do not match its deeds. Moscow said if the U.S. truly wants to build dialogue, it needs to abandon its confrontational rhetoric and take practical steps to improve bilateral relations. China also reacted to Biden's speech to the Congress on his geopolitical priorities. Beijing censored Washington for its anti-Beijing sanctions and accused the U.S. of politicizing economy and technology and violating principles of fair competition. Thanks for joining us, everyone. Stay safe and bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The potential illegality of the Israeli regime military recruitment in Canada is embarrassing, and promoting a foreign army rests uneasily with even right-wing nationally thinking, which is generally sympathetic to an anti-Palestinian outlook. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by the staff of Palestine Chronicle. This article is published under the heading Campaign to Oppose Israeli Regime Military Recruitment in Canada Receives Boost. Stay tuned for more. The campaign to oppose illegal Israeli regime military recruitment in Canada has received a significant boost. A parliamentary petition calling for an investigation into IDF recruitment has quickly surpassed the number of signatures required to be presented in the House of Commons. Submitted by Rabbi David Mivasser and sponsored by NDP MP Matthew Green, the petition calls upon the Minister of Justice to undertake a thorough investigation of those who have recruited or facilitated recruiting for the Israeli regime forces and, if warranted, lay charges against those involved in recruiting and encouraging recruiting for the IDF. In 48 hours, over 1,000 individuals have signed the petition, which is twice what's required for it to be read in the Parliament. The government then has to respond. The petition is part of a multifaceted campaign that began the fall with a formal complaint, an open letter signed by Noam Chomsky, Roger Waters, filmmaker Ken Loach, author Ian Martell, former MP Jim Manley, poet Al Jones, and more than 150 others. The letter called on the federal government to apply charges under the Foreign Enlistment Act against those recruiting Canadians for the Israeli regime military. It is a crime to recruit anyone for a foreign military or to encourage any person to serve in a foreign military. The Foreign Enlistment Act states, any person who within Canada recruits or otherwise includes any person or body of persons to enlist or to accept any commission or engagement in the armed forces of any foreign state or other armed forces operating in that state is guilty of an offense. On several occasions, the Israeli regime consulate in Toronto has advertised that they have an IDF representative available for personal appointments for those wishing to join the IDF. In 2019, the consulate announced an IDF representative will conduct personal interviews at the consulate on November 11th to 14th. Young people who wish to enlist in the IDF or anyone who has not fulfilled their obligations according to the Israeli Defense Service law are invited to meet with him. Subsequently, United Jewish Appeal of Greater Toronto and Federation Combined Jewish Appeal Montreal publicized a webinar last June by Nefesh B. Nefesh titled Joining the IDF, which claimed to offer participants everything you need and want to know about joining the IDF. As part of drawing attention to the recruitment, Justice Minister David Lametti received a formal complaint and letters from nearly 1,500 individuals. Additionally, the Chief of Staff for the Office of RCMP Commissioner Rob O'Reilly received a packet of evidence and 900 emails regarding illegal Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada. The campaign has been widely covered in left Canadian and pro-Palestinian media. Why is the Israeli regime military still recruiting in Canada? Canadians should not be recruited to fight for the Israeli army. Canadians recruited for Israeli war crimes? Toronto schools push students to join Israeli military? What constitutes recruiting? Civil society groups demand action on illegal Israeli regime military recruiting in Canada, are some of the articles published on the campaign. In Quebec, Le Devoir discussed the campaign on its front page and in a follow-up article, while Journal de Montréal also ran a story on the challenge to the Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada. But in English Canada, the dominant media has ignored the evidence presented to the Justice Minister and RCMP. A number of reporters expressed interest in the campaign, but got cold feet or were stopped by their editors from covering the public letter and evidence compiled. In February, David Mastracchi wrote a powerful article about how media is ignoring illegal Israeli regime army recruitment in Canada. The lack of corporate media attention partly reflects the silence of the anti-Palestinian lobby. Generally quick to denounce pro-Palestinian activists' toxic obsession with the Israeli regime lobby has failed to find fault with a campaign suggesting they are engaged in criminal activity. They understand that publicly denouncing the anti-recruitment campaign would draw attention to an issue difficult to defend. The potential illegality of the recruitment is embarrassing, and promoting a foreign army rests uneasily with an even right-wing nationalist thinking, which is generally sympathetic to an anti-Palestinian outlook. Prominent military historian Jack Granatstein, for instance, told an interviewer, "In my view, no one who is a Canadian should be able to enlist in some other country's military and keep his Canadian citizenship." At the same time, the Israeli regime lobby doesn't want to stop convincing young people to join the IDF. According to 2017 statistics from the IDF, 230 Canadians served in the Israeli military. In 2020, 9% of the lone soldiers in the Israeli regime military were from Canada, according to the IDF. Canadians staff West Bank checkpoints and ships enforcing the blockade of Gaza. About 3,500 lone soldiers serve in the IDF. This is significant, but a relatively small proportion of the 150,000 enlisted in the Israeli regime military. The campaign to oppose the Zionist regime military recruitment in Canada challenges this ideological climate. Bringing the issue into the House of Commons is an important step in disrupting a dynamic where a young Torontonian can be in charge of overseeing Palestinian misery.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality. Back to
it's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, and our dear guests. Let me ask them to introduce themselves.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. I am Zainab. Totally stoked to be here with you guys.
Thank you. And, brother?
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you very much. My name is Sayyid Ayman Rizvi. And I've been studying in the Hawza for the last 8 years, living in Qom.
Great. Brother Ayman, without the 30 days of hunger, this is what we are supposed to actually observe in the month of Ramadan. And this month, we are prohibited to do the act, the normal act that we are doing like in the other months.
Right.
Right? So without these days of hunger, how would Ramadan be like?
I think there would not be much change, because if these 30 days aren't helping you, then there's no hope, right? There's a one point I like to mention. I was just going through some articles and some informative videos about fasting. So I just found something very interesting. Right now in the West, they have developed a system of cure, which is called water fasting.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have reached to this conclusion that fasting is really great and very
beneficial
for human body.
Mm. Yes.
And they're treating their patients for severe diseases which are incurable, you know, or uncurable at other hospitals or other medical centers.
Such as chronic headache?
Chronic headache.
Blood pressure.
Probably,
yes.
But I think now they are treating cancers as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, they just let them drink water, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, some specific dosages, you know, maybe like a half a glass of water or something like that. But anyway, this fasting is helping them over there. So, unfortunately, if we don't believe in the fasting, then we would be lost. You know, we would be losing so much, because this fasting is not only for your physical goodness. It's all, I mean, not only your spiritual goodness, it's also good for your physical goodness, mm-hmm. as well. So, yeah, you would be losing so much if there wouldn't be these 30 days.
I see. Sister Zainab, what do you think of those people who are against fasting? And they would claim mm-hmm. that fasting is not as beneficial as you would think it is for our health.
Well, it depends. I haven't fasted for the past, this year would be 6 years, right? And it's because I have a health condition. And to be perfectly honest, it sucks that I can't fast. I feel so left out. I feel like I'm not absorbing all the merits and wonderful, fulfilling feelings that you achieve during the holy month.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, yeah, Allah's door of mercy is open to all, but when you fast, and that moment when your belly is empty but your heart is full of hope and mm-hmm. you pray to Allah, you're like, yeah, that's it. Surefire, I'm going to heaven today. My life is complete. For those who say that fasting couldn't be so healthy, isn't that as healthy as you think? They're right, because it hasn't been very healthy for me. I was like rushed to the hospital a few times at my attempt at fasting.
Mm-hmm. So it's definitely forbidden for you to fast.
So forbidden. But I would say that even though I haven't been able to fast, the month of Ramadan is still a totally different vibe for me from mm-hmm. every other month.
I right? wanted to ask you the same question.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally different.
So what would you do during Ramadan?
What do I do during Ramadan?
Yes.
Since I can't fast?
Since you can't fast and you don't like experience the hunger that is experienced or felt by other people.
She enjoys the Ramadan.
Yeah, exactly. There we go. Oh my God, it is so good. Because I'm saying that my point here is that Ramadan isn't only about starving yourself.
Exactly.
I don't starve.
That's the point.
Yet I feel like God is giving me a hug during those 30 days, even though I'm not like almost going to faint from starvation. I feel the encompassing mercy, all the cleansing light, and the joy and the sense of gratification from refining myself and trying to work on my attributes and qualities and trying to be a better person and trying to contemplate on religion and the mm-hmm. holy book and a hadith and being productive in a spiritual way. I feel all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel how it lasts throughout the year for me. It's like I'm recharged during the holy month of Ramadan. So point being, maybe it's not just about starving ourselves. Ramadan within itself, in and of itself, fi nafsiha, it's so awesome. That even if you suffer from some sort of illness that prevents you from fasting, you're still going to benefit from it, because mm-hmm. that's not the essence of Ramadan at all.
Yes.
The essence of Ramadan is something so much bigger and greater than mm-hmm. just being hungry.
There's a hadith I'd like to mention
okay,
here.
Sure.
It's, I think Imam Ali alayhi salam said that fasting of a heart is better than the fasting of
the
eyes
belly.
and the fasting of the eyes is better than the fasting of stomach. So it's basically, eventually, it goes back to the fasting of your heart. And as, you know, she is missing, for example, you know, you or used to miss in the past, I think you don't have to worry about that, sister, because in Islam, we have from logical, from ethical, and from jurisprudential, you know,
aspects.
Yeah, we have the solutions for everything. Because if you are somehow unable to do anything, God is not going to judge you. God is just, right? God knows everything what's going on in this world.
Right.
So if you're missing out on something, if a person cannot pray, offer prayers standing, he can just sit. If he cannot, you know, he cannot sit, he can just lay down on the floor.
He always finds a way for you.
Always, yeah. And you, so mean you don't
flexible,
have to worry about that.
It's not rigid.
It's not rigid, exactly. So this is the beauty of Islam. It's all about your heart and your soul, the purification of your soul. So this is the true spirit of Ramadan.
So it changes shapes according to the personality, to the characteristics of
the
each and every individual,
person,
basically.
Of course, of course.
How awesome is Ramadan to you, Brother Aim?
To me, I think, you know, rest of the year, I don't have much time. I'm not that productive or creative, I think, for the rest of the year. And because since I don't eat anything and, you know, I have plenty of time, I'm just, you know, usually writing or sitting in front of my computer doing, you know, my graphic designing or whatever, video editing, so many other things. So it's just, you know, it gives you a lot of time to explore yourself, and, you know, it gives you time to play with your kids more. I mean, from every aspect, you are able to explore yourself more than the rest of the year.
I think that's the thing,
that's
the magic
nice.
Of Ramadan. It's so abundant.
Yes,
it's
exactly.
So abundant.
Exactly. I have a very good experience for the last couple of previous Ramadans. In fact, I've been either writing books or articles. And after Ramadan, they got to be published.
MashaAllah.
It's very nice. It's very bountiful.
It's a blessing of Ramadan.
Exactly.
Yes, it's very much bountiful.
And during these 30 days, we don't eat. And we're like, oh my God, I have so much time when I don't have to cook and clean and think about what to eat next. And but the month itself, it's really, like you said, bountiful. And it's abundant. And it's so fulfilling and gratifying. And you feel like, oh, you're just drowning in this ocean, this vast, endless ocean of mercy and favors and blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I know that people usually even enjoy the hunger pangs, you know, because you feel like, oh, it's so rewarding. What's your favorite part about
basically,
the fulfillment?
I don't look at it that way, whether it is rewarding or not. It's something that I look at a duty toward my God, because I, basically do a lot of activities based on my professional job, work, even hobbies and the stuff that I'm doing. And everyone does it, right? To some extent, I would follow or pursue my own career. And the other one is that, yes, I would, like, write. I would do research. And I would even watch a lot of movies and series. It's really wonderful. I'm saying that it's very much like it gives you plenty of time
so
to do
much.
Lots of things.
Exactly.
Basically, because you're not like engaged in something like eating or drinking or some of the things. It's not that I'm fat because I'm eating too
all
much.
All the time.
Like all the time without like. In other months than Ramadan, you know, it's not like that at all. But basically, I'm like dividing this time, or I share it with the other work that I have that I'm not doing in the other months.
Yeah,
basically,
exactly.
This is something to be really blessed with.
Right.
All right. Like I'm watching a lot of series during Ramadan, and it's really wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing how much everything just becomes multiplied. I feel like even the 24 hours we have in a day increases the same way that the rahmah increases and the rizq increases, the knowledge increases, the spirituality increases, the provisions. And I think another thing about the holy month of Ramadan that you know, even with, so the first question we started off from was that how would it be without the starving part, right?
Yes.
So I'm Well, I want to say that it's cool even with the starving part because you feel so devoted during the holy month. Mm-hmm. You know, every gesture, every movement, every action, every deed, every breath, every nap, you know, like Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam says during his the sermon he delivered at the end of Sha'ban, that everything you do will be rewarded. The breath of the fasting person, the mm-hmm. sleep of the fasting person, yes. their recitation, their everything is multiplied and amplified, and everything you do is just so devoted to Allah, and that is so fulfilling. That gives you so much purpose. It's like your entire life just boils down to the month of Ramadan. This is what I've been living for.
Watching serials and films.
Well, yes, watching
even
series.
That have a reward, right?
Exactly.
For our host.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Your series watching are rewarded during the month of Ramadan.
But Brother Imam, what do you say to those people who are living in the hot regions of the earth and they have to go through all the hoops of thirst and hunger and the long hours, yes. like during summer?
Well, from one perspective, I think they are lucky. But from the other perspective, they are unlucky, because if they are disadvantaged, you know, then that's a problem. But, you know, in a hadith, I've seen that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the Ramadan, the hotter, you know, the season in which you fast, mm-hmm. it has more reward. So mm-hmm. Imam Ali alayhi salam also said in Najr Balagha that I think few things from your world, he mentions, and then one thing was the fasting in the summer. So, you know, Imam Ali alayhi salam loves that. But, you know, of course, your question is basically about the people who are underprivileged or maybe disadvantaged. It's for
like
them,
labor
again,
workers, they have to fast and they have to go work under the scorching sun.
Yeah.
On a building or something.
But again, you know, there is an exemption for some people, because if they can't do it, if it's really hard on their health or mm-hmm. their body,
exactly.
they don't have to fast.
Religion doesn't require yeah. those people who are not like tolerating it.
Exactly.
All right. One way or another. Sister Zainab, what do you say to those people who have to go through the trouble of, in fact, not eating for long hours during summer and not drinking and feel the thirst through the hot seasons?
But
if they can go to cool areas,
yeah.
for example?
Well, I don't think everyone has the privilege of doing that, you know,
yes.
traveling to their cabin in Switzerland where the weather is nice.
In the Alps.
Subtle in the Alps, you know, watching little fluffy sheep graze in the mountains. And no, we don't have, not everyone has that luxury in life.
But at least they can sleep more.
Can they do though? I mean, what about their working hours?
Well, at
the end of the day, here's the thing. If you can do it, good on you. More power to you. Kudos to you. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will reward you big time. You're such a good, strong, awesome person, and I'm so proud of you. But if you can't and you feel like, all right, it's either I lose my job and my sustenance and I can't support my family,
mm-hmm.
or like I burn in hell, well, you know, go for a drive every morning. Go past the city limits where you
yeah.
can break your fast and just come back in. You know, there's a solution to everything.
Yes.
I'm the last person to give any solutions regarding fasting struggles because I don't fast.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not proud of it, but it is what it is. Alhamdulillah ala kulli hal. But there are so many solutions. And, oh, it's really important for us to fix our diet too.
Mm-hmm.
So, so important.
What do you mean? Like eat stronger or
no,
more
no, no.
nutritious
eat
food?
More nutritious food that help with water retention in your body and give you proper energy.
Like
and
dates or something.
Exactly. Dates and sawiq. There's something in the medicine of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. It's basically like roasted ground barley or lentils or something like that. Try to eat like natural sugar, not processed sugar. Try to fit more fiber into your diet and this and that. There's so many things that we can do, but at the end of the day, good luck.
Mm-hmm. Brother Iman, how about another solution, like stop speaking too much? Like if you speak too much, you're going to feel like very thirsty mm-hmm. in the mouth.
For some people, probably, it would be a solution not to speak much. But usually, people can opt and people can, you know, basically get familiar with this idea, because they get fast every year. So like me, you know, for example, it's easier for me to understand this phenomena that, you know, I know that I get thirsty every year in the month of Ramadan, but I can handle it. But probably for children or probably for the young people, I think you can tell them, you guide them, you know.
That, and I started with the physical benefits. What about the spiritual benefit of not speaking too much?
Yeah. Oh, of course. There are a lot of benefits for not speaking much.
Like we know that for sure that some of the disciples of Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, they used to put some kind of pebbles or a stone, very small stones in the mouth, like whenever they felt the need to speak for real, they could have gotten the pebbles out and then they start speaking, all right? But other than that, they would like they would see it like a trouble, all right? Like a problem for them to every time to get the pebbles out of the mouth and start speaking. So this could teach them a lesson not to speak all the time.
Yeah.
So speaking like for genuine reasons could be like the real speech, basically.
Yes, exactly. That's actually a practice, a sort of a spiritual practice to reach, you know, towards God in a way that you don't indulge in, you know, other actions.
Right.
Just think about God, you know, 24 hours, you know.
Yes.
Every moment just thinking about God. So, because if you will start speaking, usually what happens that, you know, when you are given a chance to speak, you just like to speak all the time. You just like to speak about your life, about your everything. So that's, I think, one of the, you know, thing which is related to your spirit and soul, that you always wanted to speak a lot.
Thank you very much, Brother Eamon.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Sister Zainab. And
thank you,
the dear audience, for listening to your program Back to Reality on RIB English Radio.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight.
Under a Hermetic Israeli regime blockade since 2006, the densely populated Gaza Strip lacks basic services like clean water, electricity, or minimally equipped hospitals. Therefore, long before COVID-19 ravaged many parts of the world, Palestinians in Gaza were dying as a result of easily treatable diseases such as diarrhea, Salmonella, and typhoid fever. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Ramzi Barood, a journalist. This article is published under the heading A Palestinian Prayer for Ramadan. May the voices of the oppressed be heard. Here's more. COVID-19 cases in Palestine, especially in Gaza, have reached record highs, largely due to the arrival of a greatly contagious coronavirus variant, which was first identified in Britain. Gaza has always been vulnerable to the deadly pandemic. Under a hermetic Israeli regime blockade since 2006, the densely populated Gaza Strip lacks basic services like clean water, electricity, or minimally equipped hospitals. Therefore, long before COVID-19 ravaged many parts of the world, Palestinians in Gaza were dying as a result of easily treatable diseases such as diarrhea, salmonella, and typhoid fever. Needless to say, Gaza's cancer patients have little fighting chance as the besieged strip is left without many life-saving medications. Many Palestinian cancer patients continue to cling to the hope that the Israeli regime's military authorities will allow them access to the better-equipped Palestinian West Bank hospitals. Alas, quite often, death arrives before the long-awaited Israeli regime permit does. The tragedy in Gaza, in fact, in all of occupied Palestine, is long and painful. Still, it ought not to be classified as another sad occasion that invokes much despair but little action. In fact, the struggle of the Palestinians is integral to a larger struggle for fundamental human rights that can be witnessed throughout the West Asia region, which, according to a recent Carnegie Corporation report, is one of the most economically unequal regions in the world. From war-torn Libya to war-torn Syria to Yemen, Iraq, Somalia, Sudan, Afghanistan, and many parts of the Arab and Muslim world, the dual tragedy of war and want is a scathing reminder of the price ordinary people pay for frivolous power struggles that yield nothing but more uncertainty and achieve nothing but more hatred. Once more, the holy month of Ramadan visits the Muslim Ummah while its tragedies are still festering. New conflicts, unfinished wars, an ever-spending death toll, and a never-ending stream of refugees. Sadly, not even Ramadan, a month associated with peace, mercy, and unity, is enough to bring about, however, fleeting moments of tranquility or a respite from hunger and war for numerous Muslim communities around the world. In Palestine, the Israeli regime occupation often takes even more sinister turns during this month, as if to intentionally compound the suffering felt by Palestinians. On April 14th, Sheikh Mohammed Hussein, the Grand Mufti of Al-Quds and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, called on Arabs and Muslims to intervene so that the Israeli regime may cease its harassment of Palestinians at the holy shrines of Al-Quds, the occupied East Jerusalem. Aside from the increased attacks by Jewish extremists, who are now storming Al-Aqsa Mosque at a significantly higher rate than ever before, the Israeli regime occupation authorities have removed the doors of the mosque's minarets, cut the electrical wires of loudspeakers to prevent azan or call to prayer, and seized Ramadan iftar meals, in addition to threatening to storm the mosque on the final days of the holy month of Ramadan, Sheikh Hussein said in a statement. The Israeli regime fully comprehends the spiritual connection that Palestinians, whether Muslims or Christians, have to their religious symbols. For Muslims, this rapport is further accentuated during the holy month of Ramadan. Severing this connection is equal to breaking the collective spirit of the Palestinian people. These are only a few examples of a multifaceted and deeply rooted tragedy felt by most Palestinians. Numerous similar stories, though of different political and spatial contexts, are communicated every day throughout the Muslim world. Yet, there is no meaningful discussion of a collective remedy, of a strategy, of a thoughtful answer. Ramadan is indeed to be a time when Muslims are united on the basis of a wholly different criterion. Their political and ideological differences disappear in favor of a spiritual unity, which is expressed in fasting, prayer, charity, and kindness. Unfortunately, what we are witnessing is not Ramadan as it was intended to be, but different manifestations of the holy month, each catering to a different class, a painful but true expression of disunity and inequality that have afflicted the Muslim Ummah. There is the Ramadan of boundless wealth, finely catered iftar meals, coupled with endless cheap entertainment. In this Ramadan, platitudes are often offered about charity and the poor, but little is delivered. There is also the Ramadan of Palestine, Sudan, and Yemen, of the Syrian refugee camps, and of little dinghies dotting the Mediterranean, carrying thousands of desperate families, holding little but their hope of a better future beyond some horizon. For them, Ramadan is a stream of prayers that the world, especially their Muslim brethren, may come to their rescue. For them, there is little entertainment because there is no electricity and there are no massive iftar feasts because there is no money. Dua is Arabic for supplication. For the oppressed, dua is the last resort, at times even a weapon against oppression in all of its forms. This is why we often see bereaved Muslims raising their open palms to sky whenever tragedy has befallen them. Ramadan is the month where the poor, destitute, and oppressed raise their hands to heaven, beseeching God in various accents and languages to hear their prayers. They are reassured by such hadith, saying, Prophet Muhammad, as this, the supplications of three persons are never turned away, a fasting person until he breaks his fast, a just ruler, and the supplication of the oppressed, which is raised by Allah above the clouds. The gates of heaven are open for it, and the Lord says, by my might I will help you in due time. There has never been a more critical time for the Ummah to work together, to heal its collective wound, to uplift its downtrodden, to care for its poor, to embrace its refugees, and to fight for its oppressed. Many Muslim communities around the world are aching, and their pain is unbearable. Perhaps this Ramadan can serve as the opportunity for social justice to be finally enacted and for the oppressed to be heard so that their hymn of torment and hope may rise above the clouds.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.